Hello and welcome to the August 12th episode of the TMS Wiki's Tuesday Night Discussion Group. Today we are doing The Meaning of Truth, Embrace Your Truth and Create Your Life by Nicole Sachs, LCSW. We are very lucky to have Nicole herself with us tonight. And tonight we will be discussing chapters 3, 4, and 4 and a half in this book. Speaking of scheduling issues, before we started the recording, we were just discussing a question that we had. I like to think of the 20 minutes or the half hour before the show officially starts as kind of being lobby time when people will call in and discuss things a little bit. And during this, someone brought up how they would love to hear about TMS-aware parenting. And so we were just talking about the possibility of doing a whole show on that with Nicole. And I'm very happy to say that that could actually happen. So
it will absolutely happen. We'll figure it
wonderful.
Out.
Wonderful. So before we begin, I do have to say that this is basically a book group. We come and discuss and share our experiences as peers. If you have a medical or mental health issue, you should see an appropriately licensed practitioner. This can't substitute for that. We, of course, would suggest a TMS-aware practitioner. Also, of course, the opinions expressed here are the opinions of their speakers. It is a fairly unmoderated discussion, and the opinions do not necessarily represent those of the PBDTMS Peer Network, the nonprofit which is sponsoring this discussion. So with that, I will begin. Thank you, Nicole, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Herbie, my regular co-host, will not be joining us this week, so let us dive in. The first chapter is chapter 3, and it is about I See You. And believe it or not, I have never seen Avatar. So I had to go check it out, but there was a quote which I thought was excellent, which kind of summarized what you said in here, which I just found fascinating. You wrote, before we can attain the connectedness, which is our lifeblood, human beings need to be seen for their soft, vulnerable, lovely selves, lovely true selves, no matter how flawed. People need to be seen before they can be loved right or treated right. I thought that was a great explanation of why being seen is so important, and I was wondering if you could expand upon that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the most important things that I try to get across in my practice and in my book is that so many times we're like, I'm fine, I'm good, don't worry about me, I've got it. You know, I'm a parent, I'm a whatever I am, whatever you do for work, you know, and you don't worry so much about if people see you. You worry if you see other people and if they are going to be okay. And I think a lot of TMS personalities tend to be that way, which is, you know, we've got it, don't worry about it, you know, I can take care of everything, I'm fine. And so one of the most important things I thought when I started writing this book is I have to lay it out for people who are these TMS personalities. And I have to say that's important that you are also seen. And when I work with people, a lot of times they don't even get it until I say it out loud, and until I say, hey, guess what? Stop. Like, it's not just about taking care of your family or your husband or your wife or your kids or your employees. Like, how about you? And people freak out. They're like, wait, what? No, no, don't even look at me. And so that's something really, really important. And the reason that Avatar was what inspired me is because I thought it was going to be a super cheesy movie and I was not excited to see it. And this is, you know, years ago when it first came out. And when I saw it, the thing that was cool is that in that scene where he's dying, he was only an avatar prior. So he's in love with this. If anyone's seen the movie, they get it. That he was in love with that massive blue woman, and he was a massive blue guy because he was an avatar. But when he turns back into a human, he's dying. He's gasping for breath because he can't breathe in this, God, I forget the name of it, but the water for the world.
Right, Pandora, yeah.
In Pandora. she doesn't care. She's angry at first, but she gets past it. And all she says is, I see you. It's just so beautiful to me, like that moment. And because he looks different. He looks like a human being. He's way smaller because these avatar people are like 7 feet tall. And he's just a guy. But she sees him. And that to me is a very beautiful moment. And so it kind of reflected to me how I want people to understand themselves in my practice and with my book, which is, it doesn't matter how you look. It doesn't matter what you are. You need to be seen for the raw truth of who you are, because that is the first step in accepting yourself and all your flaws, which is also the first step in overcoming TMS. So, you know, that's kind of what the inspiration for that chapter was.
Well, and it seems very much about connected with the idea of truth, that you have to accept that truth. When someone says, I see you, in some sense, I'm seeing you for the truth of who you really are, and I'm accepting that.
Yes. And I'm not seeing the perfect, polished version of you that you have been trying to allow the world to only see for the last 20 years, because that's created your TMS. You know, when you have this perfect, you know, polished thing that you put out into the world, people are owing, they're going to see that, and then you're going to feel the need to uphold it. And that's the thing that can really make people suffer. And I've suffered myself tremendously over that person that I've tried to uphold and still do. I mean, you know, it's a never ending journey, but it can be a journey that doesn't require you to be in chronic pain. And that's something that I really try to get across to people.
Yeah. It's interesting when you talk about those two versions, you actually talked about, you explained that idea on page 38 of the book. You said, each person's story exists on two levels. That sounds like you were just talking to, can you, perhaps we could go into that now.
And remember last week for us when I was doing the thing and you wanted me to talk about
yes,
it?
Right.
That's like what
the visual cue.
Yeah. So the visual cue is, you know, there's the level where we walk the earth. Okay. So it's like my work, my job, my kids, my financial responsibilities, my hopes, my dreams, whatever it is. And those are stressful. Those are legitimately stressful. So that's fine. But then there's a deeper truth that when people are reading the book, they're going to understand, that's much uglier, about, you know, how sometimes we hate ourselves, or sometimes we don't believe in God, or sometimes we hate our parents, or sometimes we doubt, you know, the very tenets that made up our beliefs as we've grown. And these are things we need. If that tree falls in the forest, we hear it, even if we don't admit it. And so that's the things that I want to encourage people to look for, the deeper truth, even if it's not pretty to hear, because the only person who needs to hear it is you. And that's something that I think people really struggle with. And I remember on the Sarno panels, people ask that question all the time. And like we said last week, you don't have to change your life, but you do have to recognize what you really feel.
Which does get back to that idea of being seen. So the part of you that needs to be seen and needs to be accepted is that deeper truth. It's the uglier part.
It is. And sometimes it's hard. And that's why sometimes you need help. Sometimes you need either a therapist or maybe a group, you know, to allow yourself to accept that.
Right, right. So I am kind of curious about why actually being seen is so important. I mean, why is it that we need to be seen? Can't we just do this exploration on our own, or how is that important? Why a whole chapter about being seen?
Well, you know, I don't want to say that we can't do this exploration on our own, because I don't want to leave that out, because people can. But in the end, support really, really matters. I mean, you know, I have a whole host of clients who are in certain different 12-step programs. I have a whole host of clients who are in different support groups, whether it's TMS or other things, or they call into things like this. Anytime you open yourself to support of other human beings, you are less alone and you are more apt to heal. And so, for me, it's not imperative, but it really helps if somebody else can see you. And if anyone who's listening tonight, if you think about it, you can feel really shameful, or you can feel really scared, or really lost, or really alone. And if one person in the world says, hey, I totally get it. I totally get it. I totally see what you're going through. I've been there. Or I just understand, your whole world softens just a little bit. And I think that's why I dedicated a whole chapter to it, because when I'm in my office, people who work with me directly, the first thing I do is make sure they understand that I see them. I mean, I don't want them putting on airs. I don't want them defending themselves at all. It's a waste of their time, especially with me. Mm-hmm. And they can do it in the world because I understand why people need to do it in the world. Mm-hmm. But with me, no. And that's an enormous part of my work with people.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of people, I want to incorporate as many voices as possible. We've got quite a few people on the line, and I just wanted to throw it open because you guys have wonderful perspectives, and we have an awesome audience. And I was wondering, does anyone have any stories which you want to relate, any connections which these discussions spark for you, this notion of being seen? Do you guys think it's important to be seen? Can this be done on its own?
I have a question, Forrest, and I definitely
love it. You
know, when I'm alone or with certain people, it's a lot easier to kind of achieve that state of just being and not acting. In other situations, whether it's when I'm working or whether it's at a house party or things like that, there's, and I think this is common with TMS from what I've read, there's a level of anxiety. You want to kind of look good. So what's your kind of advice for when you're in those places around people or crowded areas where you kind of feel that tension and you feel self-conscious? Like, how do you be in that kind of situation?
You want me to take that, Forrest?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Here's what I have to say about that. You just need to have truth with yourself, okay? So if you are having TMS symptoms, let's say, okay, and you're in a party situation and other people are making you feel uncomfortable, you can take a quiet moment. You can go to the restroom. You can just sit within. You can even be in the room and be like, I know what I feel right now. That guy's an asshole. That girl just made me feel stupid. That person just tried to talk to me and I didn't know how to answer her back. I don't want to be here anyway. I only came here because my friend wanted me to come, and look, he's ignoring me. Like, whatever. And I just picked that stuff out of the air, okay? Because I know that there's a lot of things we can all feel in those situations. Say it to yourself. I know how I feel. I know what's going on right now. I don't need to pretend. I'm okay. This is kind of a shitty night. I hate it. But, you know, I'm not leaving yet because I'd feel worse leaving. And whatever it is, I promise you, if you can do this as a practice, your TMS will not own you. And that's something that can be used anywhere.
Well, that does strike a chord. There was one time about a month ago when there were some people gathered. I live in a big apartment complex, and there were some people gathered. And normally when I go out, I get a certain amount of anxiety. This time I felt kind of I was kind of in a different state. I was a little more angry about something, and I kind of went down there and was not in that kind of nervous state, and was just more like, screw it, I'm gonna just say what I'm gonna say. Yeah. And it felt better. And yeah. I'm trying to learn how to kind of be that way more. It's like a shift in my mind, but it's a slow shift. It's kind of hard to get there.
Yeah, I get that. It's like, you don't want to be like this angry screw it guy, but you don't want to be owned by your TMS. No, I totally hear you. And so what I will say is, what I just said is basically screw it, but it's not angry. It's just mostly peace with how you really feel, you know? So like, if you're like kind of feeling like this is a shitty situation and I don't really want to be here, or I don't give a shit what these people think and I'm just going to screw it, just know it. Know it for yourself. It makes such a huge difference. Play it like a game. Be like, I'm just going to see how it feels to really know it. And it doesn't mean flipping people off, because actually that could make your TMS worse, because you don't want to be like the jerk that like is like, you know, hating everyone. But really, it is it's a very useful experiment that you can do with yourself.
Definitely. Yeah. No, that sounds good. And I think for me, at least, coming from a different place inside myself, a place I'm not used to coming from, I'm used to coming from the kind of people pleasing. I want everyone to like me. coming from not a place of being a jerk, but kind of a more balanced place. And I've never learned to come from that. And so that's.
Yeah. And that is something that is truly hard to learn because we are taught to be nice. We're taught to be polite. We're taught to make everyone happy. And, you know, that's something that unless it totally comports with how you're feeling in your heart can cause TMS really badly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The tension, you feel it. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that question, Joseph. That was very helpful. Anyone else have any questions? They want to jump in or are willing to share experiences about connectedness and its importance, et cetera, and when to share one's truth and when not to? Well, let me move on then. I want to say, speaking of sharing one's truth, the lines are open. You may notice your microphone occasionally getting muted if you're using the computer. You'll see it, and you can unmute it, but be careful. There may be a reason why I'm muting you. I'm trying the best to decrease the background noise. So one of the metaphors that you used fairly heavily throughout this chapter was the idea of a lens. You talk about how we, what is it that muddies our lens? Like, and I guess I'm kind of interested in this, because we've talked about connectedness and how important connectedness is. And when I think about what's muddying our lenses and preventing us from embracing our truth, is in some sense what Steve Ozanich might call ego. So I guess one thing which struck me in reading these chapters were the parallels to Steve-O's book, where in some sense, the bad guy seems to be ego. Ego is, and the good guy seems to be connectedness. So I was wondering if you could just comment on that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, connectedness is always the good guy. So I have to just say that like straight up, like any connectedness we can find, you know, I mean, a lot of times I say in my book, you know, welcome, you're a member of the human race. You know, you have a lot of people out there that are also members of your team. So connectedness and support are, you know, paramount no matter what. Ego. Okay, so ego. I mean, I've done a lot of studies on this because, you know, I have my background's in psychology and then I have a master's in social work. Ego is a word that has too many definitions for me to use ego for helping people. I can't use that word because it's confusing, which is why I've tried to find other words. Okay, so when I say a lens, I'm more comfortable with that word because the word ego, I mean, people could start talking Freudian, people could start talking self-worth. I mean, there's so many things that, you know, the word ego can bring about. But if we talk about our lens, okay, so let's talk about nature versus nurture, which of course is an age-old debate, but I think it's a ridiculous debate because we are all a version of nature and nurture put together. I can't imagine that anybody would think otherwise. I mean, you know, we're born with certain proclivities to be a certain way, and then we have the way we were raised and what we're given, right? So when I say a lens, I say that, and let's go to birth. So I'm born, and I'm born, let's say, and this is not, by the way, me, but I'm just picking anything.
Yes.
This is the way my brain works. I just take things out of the air. Okay, so let's say I'm born in a poverty-stricken environment in a black community where I don't see any people of any other races, and this I'm saying I'm like really picking some things. I have one client that I'm really working with who is dealing with this. They are so paranoid, or he is so paranoid of being judged and being judged by people upon his race. Where I have a client who is also black, African-American, whatever you want to call it. I don't like to use anything politically correct, unfortunately, sorry. Neither do any of my clients. And that person was adopted and raised in a white family, okay? And those two lenses are completely different because those two people, whatever their natures were when they were born, have been nurtured in different ways. So when they look at the world, when they look at relationships or when they look at their TMS and what they're struggling with, they see it through a lens that is, when I say muddied, that sounds like a negative, but it's really just a reality of it's different. you know, maybe they're feeling that people are judging them, or maybe they're feeling like they're left out. Like, you know, this one client who was adopted into a white family felt different, whereas my client who was not adopted, who was raised in a ghetto kind of situation, doesn't feel left out, but feels like everyone is judging him. So there is a different way we all see the world. And I think what's important, it kind of goes back to I see you. It does go back to I see you, is whoever you are, however you were raised, whatever you were born into, when we struggle with TMS, PPD, mind, body, whatever, symptoms, we struggle the same. We have the same pain. And so we need to understand that we need to be seen exactly for who we are through that lens that we see out. And then when we can relax and stop being defensive, because we're not defending all the things that that lens has been building throughout our lives, we can be heard, and then we can start to heal. So I don't know if that answers the question, because sometimes I get off topic, but
no, it is very helpful. Yes, one of the questions which I think is interesting, and maybe I phrased it wrong in terms of the lens rather than in terms of the truth, but what prevents us from seeing our truth? Are there common factors that you and your practice have noted of what are the obstacles that prevent us from seeing our truth?
Good question. Fear, defensiveness, which is also connected to fear. The word fear just keeps coming up.
It reminds me of Dr. Sarno in his interview, where he always emphasized your TMS is trying to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're so scared. I mean, we are the scaredest people, our society, our world. Go ahead.
How did we get so scared in terms of nature, you know, speaking of nature versus nurture, but yeah, how did we get this scared?
Society, polite people, you know, children can be seen and not heard. I mean, you know, depending on your generation, the fear comes from all different places. For me personally, because I moved a lot as a child and I was an only child, so I didn't have siblings, my fear was, are people going to accept me? Am I going to have friends? Am I going to be invited? Am I going to be included? You know, and so that kind of fear generates a lot of behaviors, like I'm going to be quiet and make sure I know what everybody else is saying before I speak because I need to be included. Or I'm going to make sure that once I get the lay of the land, I'm going to change my personality to be what these people need me to be. And that is a lot of TMS generated there, because that's
stuffing. I was just going to say
stuffing a lot of who you are in order to accommodate the environment that you are in.
Can anyone on the call relate to that? Anyone want to jump in?
Yeah, you just described me. My TMS started really when I was about 11, around middle school, and that's the age when really the cliques form, and you know, being hypersensitive, I felt judged, I felt kind of emotionally bullied, and everything you just said, like adjusting my own personality to kind of gain acceptance and gain you know, good vibes from others, and
you know, it's hard. You stuff all that you really are then.
Yeah.
Because there's no room for that then.
Absolutely.
And it's a natural defense mechanism. I mean, I don't want to make it seem like it's weird. I mean, I think probably most people do it. But if you have a sensitivity to your own emotions, and if you're a little bit, you know, connected to where you have this fear and the sadness, and you can't deal with it properly, it can come out in your body. It's got to come out somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it's helping. I'm liking this a lot, because I've been talking to my therapist a lot about, and journaling a lot about, my parents, and we haven't really gotten real far. And I think I'm going to focus a lot more on that, on the other kids and the other teenagers, because really, as we're having this discussion and you're talking, I'm thinking back, and you know, it's almost like I was kind of performing, basically.
Yes, absolutely. No, I remember consciously in high school having the thought that tell me who I need to be and I'll put that mask on.
Yeah. I'm an only child too, by the way. So I know. I was an only child in a very kind of upper middle class kind of, you know, where things are suppressed. That was just the culture.
So for us, what Joe's saying is answering your question even more. Why are we like this? Well, because the culture of our lives, most of us, is you suppress it. Okay, so like if it's upper middle class, it's you suppress it because, you know, everyone's just going to be just so. And if it's, you know, maybe lower income, it's because no one gives a shit. No one's going to listen to you anyway. And, you know, I have people from all walks of life and they all kind of come to the same place, which is I did not have a voice, or my true self did not have a voice.
Right, right. Which and to some degree, the feeling is toughen up. Which does come to the question of, okay, so what do you do if you have to toughen up? But I think maybe you've talked about that already, because you've already talked about what to do at the party when you were answering that question at the beginning. You said, well, it's okay. Tell me if I got this right. You don't have to let all the feelings out. You just have to know that they exist. You have to be able to access them to know what's
there. You have to be able to say to yourself, I know exactly what's happening right here. That person just said something to me. It hurt my feelings. That person just looked at me and made me feel like I'm not welcome here. That person made me feel like I was welcome here, but I feel guilty leaving the person I'm sitting next to go talk to them. Like, there's so many things that go on that are so silly in our minds. We're like, oh, that's not a big deal. But it is a big deal, actually, because we can suffer from the smallest things. Especially depending on how our, you know, as Dr. Sarna says, we have a reservoir of rage within us. And if it's at maximum volume, we are going to suffer, because we can't take one more thing.
Right.
So.
All right. So, in terms of the seeing each other and the importance, and seeing ourselves and the importance of doing that, I almost want to, You were describing your role as a therapist and how one of the most important things you do is you see people, and you give them that gift. And I think a lot of what we need to do in reading the book and in applying the book, because it isn't just reading, it's all about, can you do the work? Can you find a way to, and I know I need to do this myself, you know, I need to do some of this hard work, but
I need to do it too. Can I tell you something? Like, to be completely honest, I don't journal every day, but I should. And I think anyone can benefit from it. So I want to bring connection to that, Forrest, and say it's not easy. And when you screw it up and you fall off the wagon, just get back on, because life is long and life is better if you connect with yourself.
The journal's feelings won't be hurt, right? You know?
Nope. Doesn't care.
Right.
Go for it.
So it does feel like there is this gift of sight, which is our job to cultivate. And I wondered about the benefits of turning this gift of sight outward, where, you know, we can see our own vulnerable humanity and accept it, our own truth, and accept that and embrace it. Are there important benefits to be gained from turning that same sight outwards? Does that help? I mean, I know one of the classic stories that we hear is people who journal, it seems like there's a process of, you start writing about something, you realize how much you hate people, and then you find that you can actually love them as well, perhaps by embracing their truth. Certainly that's what happened in Avatar. He's like, oh, you're a spy and you killed all of us. And I can still love that part of you. Can you talk a little bit about that, about turning it outward?
Well, you know, I can, but I'm going to be honest with you. Remember when we were talking the first, I think we've been three times, and
okay.
And I said, like, that's chapter 9.
Okay.
I'm just going to be honest. I'm just taking care of you, Forrest, and I'm taking care of everybody by saying, yes, we can turn it outward. But to be honest, this is a very selfish process and it needs to be.
Okay.
We need to prioritize ourselves first. When we are suffering, the reason we're suffering is because we've been turning it outward too much. We've been giving and giving and giving so much in our lives. And it doesn't mean we don't give. It doesn't mean we aren't the same lovely people we've always been. But it's about saying, wait, I can actually feel what I feel like feeling. And I can prioritize myself. And if everyone else thinks it's bullshit, I can say, fuck you. And that is part of the process. And I know, especially when I work with people that haven't given themselves that permission, they love that. I mean, that is like they laugh and they love it. And I like it because they need to prioritize themselves sometimes. And so, yes, you can turn it outward. And yes, it is about sharing the fact that you can own your own truth. But when you have real serious TMS, especially when it's really affecting your life on a day-to-day basis, which I lived and I'm sure you lived, and all probably everyone who's listening to this has lived to some extent.
We were hearing some tough stories before in the lobby section. So, yep, so, keep going.
Yeah,
sorry.
I mean, I definitely want to say that, yes, there is a space to turn it outward, but I want everyone in this call to be selfish. I want everybody to think of themselves, even if it's just only in their journal, even if it's only with their therapist, even if it's only in their private thoughts, because it's okay. And that's okay. And I think as human beings, with like our polite society and everything, we need permission to say, it's okay, you know, whatever. Like, I'm going to think of how I really feel in this situation, you know, not just taking care of everyone else. So I don't mean to shoot down your question, but, you know.
I love it.
That's why I get paid the big bucks.
And there you go. Well shot down. I totally agree. Excellent point. Anyone want to jump in on that? By the way, you can jump in at any point. Just bowl on in. But I know that's tough.
How many people do we have? How many people do we have tonight for us?
I think we have. It always does this. It always tapers down a little bit. So I think we're at about 14 now.
Well, that's a lot of people. Come on. Does anybody have a question? Come on. Look at me. I'm here in my pajamas. My dog's over there. Look. Wait, no. There he is. Does everyone see my dog?
I can't, actually, but...
I'll grab him and bring him into the shot in a minute. But seriously, like, if anyone has a question, you know, I'm really open to hearing it.
I'll go ahead. I have a question. This is Ellen. In one of the chapters, you talked about medication, and you said something about if it helps then people to do the work, then you feel like medication is an ally to you as a therapist. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a little more, because I think that's really complicated for many of us that are sort of struggling with that issue.
Yeah, Ellen, I think that's a fantastic question because people feel a lot of stigma about using a medication of any kind. I have no opinion about medication in terms of pro or con. What I say is if people try a medication and it helps them to calm down enough to do the work they need to do or to come to the self they need to talk to, then why not? I guess it goes along with my whole kind of indignant attitude about appropriate society. You know, I don't believe that there's anything to hold true unless it's true for you. So, you know, if your family or your society around you said taking medication makes you weak, then I'm like, well, that's bullshit because that's not true for you if it's not true for you. So I think that if people find a medication that makes them feel less anxious or less depressed, I mean, I said to myself before this started, I wasn't going to be able to get through it without mentioning Robin Williams. You know, I'm 42 years old. He was one of the greatest influences in terms of like loving comedy my whole life. And I can't believe he killed himself. And what I want to say to all those people and all the celebrities who were like, oh, our hearts are broken. Well, didn't you recall like last week, you know, like when you knew he was so depressed and so isolated, like, and maybe they did. And maybe his depression was so bad that it was unstoppable. And I've known people like that. So I do not judge. But I guess what I'm saying is if a medication can help you be less anxious, help you be less depressed, help you be less guarded, then I say, why not? Why not anything? As long as it's not destructive to your body or to your soul.
I guess the why not that comes to my mind is that maybe it keeps me from seeing the truth or from feeling my true emotions.
And that I cannot speak to whether that is true or not, but I will tell you, Ellen, that, in my opinion, has never stopped somebody that I've known. I think people have a view. Well, I don't want to ask you this personally. I don't want you to answer this personally, but I want to say it. If a person has never, ever taken a medication, sometimes they have an idea about it that it is going to be a little different than it really is. And so maybe that could be forming your opinion, but, and I don't want you to answer because I'm not asking you a personal question, but what I want to say is that in my professional experience, taking an anti-anxiety or an antidepressant has not stopped people from finding their truth, has not helped people hide. Quite frankly, it's been the opposite. And so I just think that it's more about not giving things meaning that need less meaning. Like, you know, if the medication, if it's, I always hear, here's the best thing I can say. I say to my clients who take meds, take it like a vitamin. Don't take it like it's going to solve your problems. Don't take it like it's going to substitute for, you know, connecting with yourself, but take it if it helps you. So that's kind of the best I can say about it.
That actually was on my list of questions. You scooped me, Ellen. Good job.
I'm sorry. I just want to ask real quick, because I want to say to Ellen, my therapist said the exact same thing that Nicole said, that don't worry about the medication. I wanted to ask Nicole, aside from antidepressants or anti-anxiety, what about like opiate painkillers? Have you found that those have been a block? Or it's the same thing. It's been.
I have a little bit of a different feeling toward opiate painkillers. Yes, to be honest with you, but that's because of Dr. Sarno. Because yeah. When I used to sit on these panels, there were people that came in and said, "Well, I take a Percocet every 4 hours," and Dr. Sarno was pretty vocal about. He didn't tell people not to do it. He actually never took that much of a stand, but he would say. There was one panel. I was asked directly about it, specifically by a man who was taking opiates every day. And Dr. Sarno interrupted, because he always interrupted when it was a medical question and it wasn't for the panel. And I said to Dr. Sarno, "May I answer from my perspective?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "In my opinion, if you're taking opiates every single day, it's keeping you in pain." I've taken every opiate on the planet, honey. It doesn't take away your TMS if you have it.
You know, I don't have pain, but I take every day. It's a low dose, and I'm close to going off it. But I take methadone every morning. Without it, I feel like I have the flu. It's like a mild, moderate flu feeling, and it's to the point that it's very hard to function. And it's something where I feel like in therapy and just in maybe journaling or whatever, I do better without it, and yet. To make my living and to kind of go about my daily stuff, it'd be very, very difficult without it. And something I've been struggling with for the last few months.
That's the kind of thing, yeah. I mean, yeah. I, to be quite honest with you, I cannot answer anything about methadone because I'm not a medical doctor. But if I were your therapist, what I would say is, if you want to get off it, talk to your doctor, because there's got to be a way. I mean, people do get off it. So, I mean, you know, there's got to be some like stepping down. But I truly know nothing about it. So I cannot speak to that. But I do believe that anything, and I can't speak to methadone, truly can't. But I will tell you that in terms of people who take opiate painkillers as prescribed by their doctor as because of their TMS, it can stop them from doing the level of the work with the clarity that they need. But
right.
I don't want to step into, you know, areas that I'm not, you know.
That's prudent. Yeah, that makes sense.
No, I feel that. I feel that it is blocking me somewhat in my progress, and at the same time, I needed to make money. And so I feel at a certain point, I'm close. I'm pretty close to where I'll be strong enough where I won't need it. I'm not quite there yet, but once I do, I think the progress should improve at a quicker rate. So it's kind of a timing issue at this point, but I appreciate the feedback though.
Sure.
Yeah. If I can interject, Tennis Tom here. I'm 66 and I've used antidepressants a couple of times in my life. And once I was on a junior year abroad in college, 1968 or so. And it was a rough patch, various things. My roommate got hepatitis, was in the hospital. I wasn't doing well in my courses. And when I visited my roommate, the doctor noticed I was very nervous. And he prescribed some Librium for me. And I took it, and it settled me down quite nicely within a short period of time, where I was able to function again and cope, and got through the year and did well. So it's pretty much saved me. Another time, about 5 years ago, I was in a what was diagnosed as a clinical depression, and the therapist or doctor I was seeing then prescribed Lexapro, and it just made me more anxious to the point where I thought I was having a heart attack and went to the ER like at midnight, because I thought I was having a heart attack because it got me so anxious. So I think in that call, this doctor prescribed the wrong medication for me. I think he made the wrong call. He should have. I think he thought I needed jacking up or getting more excited, and I really needed to be calmed down. I'm not sure if I got that right, but that's my feeling, because he just didn't know me well enough. Well, when I went to the ER at midnight, there's a very kindly young ER doctor who said, half the calls in the ER are for panic attacks, like you're having. You're not dying, you're not having a heart attack. And he reassured me. And after his reassurance, I went home, and it was totally felt totally relieved. I wasn't dying of a heart attack, and that I was not abnormal. That half the calls in an ER or for the same thing I was having. So I don't like to take anything except for a couple of shots of booze on occasion. I think when needed, they're needed, and they can do good. One last comment on that. I read some studies where for back pain, they found that mild doses of antidepressants can be beneficial. For grins, I tried it, I think it was Celexa, and it relieved some pain. But after a couple of weeks, I realized I was kind of like a little looking at life through a filter, kind of above it all feeling, and I stopped taking them because I tried it and got the benefit I wanted to. And then, so there are occasions when I think they're prescribed well.
So I often turn to Dr. Sarno's books in situations like this. I know in some places, I think it's in Mind Body Prescription, he talks about what do you do when there's an acute attack which is overwhelming, and he mentioned that he'll prescribe strong painkillers then, and also Matthew is a friend who is a Sarno patient, and he says that sometimes he'll be prescribed strong painkillers so that he can focus on the psychological. It helps him concentrate. From The Divided Mind, in the treatment chapter, Dr. Sarno writes, the psychologist also determines whether psychoactive medication is necessary as an adjunct to therapy, and refers the patient to a psychopharmacologist should this be the case. So I think that particular line isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of different ways that people can heal, and I think the best advice that we can give is that we should be open to whatever it is that helps us.
There you go. All right. So I realize I got to keep things moving along. So thank you everyone for the questions. But let's dive on into the next chapter, chapter 4. We've already talked a number of these things, but let me draw attention to another quote. There is nothing I can tell you about yourself that you don't know. So we're talking about the one's truth now. At the moment, you just don't know that you know. You need willingness and courage and openness to possibilities. You need permission to invite the embarrassing drunk uncle to the party. Once we have our hands on him, we can actually help him to shut up, the metaphorical drunk uncle representing you know, these pathological feelings or, you know, unhealthy feelings that you have, or we have. Otherwise, you'll worry for the rest of your life that he might show up at any significant life event. I thought this was an interesting notion of the unconscious. I think it's different from the way that I think many people read Freud. Perhaps a mid-20th century version of the unconscious is that it's deep and mysterious, and there's no way that we can access it or understand what it is. But here you're saying there's nothing I can tell you about yourself that you don't know at the moment. You just don't know that you know. And I thought that was a wonderfully accessible version of the unconscious, and something that I could relate to, that often it isn't so deep and mysterious. It's stuff that we know, and we're just fighting it because we're afraid of it.
Yeah, I think that is something that is really interesting to people. I don't think people get that they could have something in their consciousness, even below their consciousness, that about them that they don't know. But I think that it's like kind of this. Here's what I can explain it as. You know how, like, when you have intuition and, like, you know that something could be wrong, or something could be scary, or something could be unsafe, but you don't really kind of get it. You don't get it completely, but there's just an intuition somewhere under the surface. You're like, something's not quite right. That's kind of what I'm trying to explain here with the unconscious. It's like we have an understanding that things aren't perfect, that there is an unspoken thing that we have in ourselves that we haven't said, but we don't know exactly what it is. And that's why I'm inviting people to just open themselves to possibilities, that there is a drunk uncle, there is an embarrassing family, you know, member, there is part of us that we don't trust or we don't feel safe with, that we can heal that, we can mend that. We don't have to be victim to that. And that's kind of what I'm saying, just opening oneself to the possibility that there's more to us than we know. There's more to know about ourselves. And if we are quiet and peaceful enough with ourselves and listen to what we have to say, we can actually connect with that, and we don't have to be a victim of any of those things anymore. So that's kind of, it's an opening of possibilities that I'd like people to embrace.
And am I right that this is pretty empowering, in that you know where to start, because you have maybe the inkling of where to go, or do you not know where to start, would you say?
Either. And that's the thing. And that's kind of why when I was writing this book, I struggled with that concept, because I want everyone to feel included. So sometimes you know where to start, sometimes you have no clue where to start. But if you can just hang on and keep reading and opening yourself every time you feel defensive and saying, oh, whatever, this isn't for me, I really have fibromyalgia, or like I have back pain that can't be helped, or, you know, my shoulder thing, it's never going away, or anything, you know. If you don't listen to that voice, and you can just give yourself the gift of just being peaceful and reading through and trying to understand what might be in there, that's something that can be a huge gift to yourself. You will get there. Everyone will get there with willingness.
Anyone from our audience want to riff on that, or ask a question about whether you know where to start or not? Do you guys feel like you know where to start?
No. It's mouth mom. Yeah. No, I don't know. I'm so lost of what to do anymore, you know? So I feel, you know,
well,
I'm one of those.
Well, do you want to talk about that?
Go ahead.
I want to ask you a question, Matt's mom. I want to ask you a question. Have you read through the whole book, or are you reading with the chapters that we're doing?
No, I read your whole book like a year ago. Yeah.
Okay. Because if you really don't know what you're doing, then what I would say is just get to the how chapter, because you've already read the whole book. So go to the how chapter, make your lists, and go through them one by one. Do you have a good therapist?
Yep.
Do it like a job. You will get it. You will get to it. It's amazing what you will find if you just do it, like, even if you're pissed off and you feel like you don't want to do it. That's, you know, the sign that you need to do it more. But I really encourage anybody who feels like they don't know where to start, or they don't know where they've come, to try I mean, I got it straight from Dr. Sarno, and I give him all the credit in the book, but what I'm saying is it's what saved me and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, not hundreds of thousands, but thousands of people through the years that I worked with him, watching them get through it from this basic tenet, which is make your three lists and go through them and be able to understand where each of them could be affecting you.
How does that sound, Massimo?
Well, I guess I just feel lost because I feel like I've done all of that. I feel like I have vomited up on everything, you know, like I have volumes of journals filled and have met with a therapist for a year and just, you know, have read Sarno, have read you, have, you know, I'm lost anymore. I don't know what to do because the pain is so chronic every day. And I just feel like I'm not making a dent. And I've been more honest about myself and more open than I ever have been. And and nothing changes. The pain does not change.
Well, that concerns me because that's a lot of work you've done. And obviously, I can't, you know, like Forrest said at the beginning, I obviously can't diagnose or treat you in this group. But I definitely think it's something. Now, are you working with a TMS therapist?
She is not. No, I'm in an area, but she is. She should be. I mean, she's really on board and totally understands it.
Well, that's great. You know, I mean, I don't want to speak to anything personally right now, but I do think that, like, that's a lot of work you're doing. And so maybe the problem is with the patience and kindness for yourself. If you're pressuring yourself too much, but, you know, we can discuss this offline. You should email me.
I would add one thing, not to take away from your therapist, but, if you might want to try maybe a different therapist, because I saw two therapists before I saw my current one, and they were not TMS trained. And to be blunt, they weren't that great anyway. It was a long time ago. But the guy I'm seeing now, he's a TMS trained therapist. He had TMS himself, and he kind of knew like where to dig, I think, which was a really big thing. So I don't know if that's something that you should do or not, but consider it maybe.
Yeah, there's just not one in my area, and pay for one, like, you know, they're just, you know, I could find.
You can do phone or Skype. I did phone calls with Donald Dubin, and I found them the next best thing, or maybe as good. So, I really think having a bona fide TMS therapist who understands what you're going through can be helpful. Or if you're at a point where nothing's working, so what do you have to lose? Try a Nicole or do it by Skype or by phone. See if that helps.
I want to say one more thing. You know, I before I went to therapy for TMS, I journaled like crazy for about 2 weeks, and it was like you. It didn't make a dent. I was reading books on TMS. I mean, it really struck me like this could really be what I'm dealing with versus the fibromyalgia diagnosis. And it was extremely frustrating. I can't even imagine for you with this much more time and not a dent, because I've had 2 weeks without a dent. And then I go to see this therapist and I come out and I thought, wow, my back's just a little bit not quite as sore. And I'm, you know, I'm feeling a little bit better. And I think for some reason, for me, I don't know why this is a case or if I'm doing it wrong or what, but I can journal all night and, you know, for months, I think. And I like between sessions, read the books, do the educational stuff, and it doesn't seem to do it. And then I talked to this TMS therapist, and it's like something in my conscious mind that's like, I kind of feel like, well, that's probably an issue. I can, it doesn't get to a deeper point in my mind. And then somehow by talking to the right person about it, and I don't think it's just him. I think it's just a good TMS therapist in general to be able to do this. I'm able to get to a deeper place and things start happening, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say that I really do feel that connection with my clients, and I want it for everyone. You know, I mean, if I could, I would work with everybody that I ever talk to about this. So I just hope for everyone listening that, you know, at least they can find some connection. If it's not a TMS therapist, any therapist, and just keep plugging at it, because it's a worthwhile struggle. It really is.
Yeah, on page 172 of your book, Nicole, I found a very helpful that chart there for people who may be struggling with, they're good prompts. It's I called it a spreadsheet for TMS, where you have three yep. different areas: childhood, daily life, and personality. And I think that could be very helpful for people who aren't sure where their issues are coming from in the reservoir of rage.
Yeah, absolutely. Helpful. Absolutely, yep.
Get the spreadsheet, yeah. Very helpful. Well, all right, we are going to run out of time here soon, and so I thought I would ask my final question, or just kind of wrap up, because we haven't spent as much time on this last chapter. So we say, we all judge ourselves so much more harshly than anyone else would, and many times this critical inner voice is at the root of our issues. It keeps us from seeing ourselves for fear of what we'll discover. And then later on you say, either way, it is boatloads easier to forgive others than it is to forgive oneself. And I wanted to say, why do you think, where does that asymmetry come from? Why is it that we're so much harder on ourselves than others are?
Well, you know, I think that it all comes down to kind of what we were discussing before, which is that there are societal norms, which are that we should be, you know, good people and generous and kind to everyone we meet and polite. And it's just kind of, it's drilled into us from when we're very young that that's like the way to be. And I think that it kind of, it masks our need to feel things for ourselves or to prioritize ourselves. And so, I mean, I guess I've just found through my life, whether it's my own experience or that of my friends and my clients, that people can forgive others really quickly. But in order to forgive ourselves, we have so much built up, whether it's our parents and the way they've spoken to us or the way we've grown up and society has spoken to us, that we don't. We would prefer to take the hit than to put the responsibility onto other people. And I guess what I was saying when I wrote that in the book is just I wanted to acknowledge that, and I wanted people to understand it, because I think a lot of people are feeling that and maybe they don't have words for it. And I wanted people to know that if they are feeling that, they're not alone, and that it's very hard for all of us to forgive ourselves when it comes to that. But I think forgiveness is a paramount issue in overcoming TMS. Once we journal ourselves silly and understand what our truths are, it's about patience and kindness and forgiving ourselves for the parts that we really had no choice. We did not have a choice about whether or not we felt that way. These are things that were given to us. And so I think it's really important for people to feel confident in understanding that about themselves.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Do you have time for one last question?
Sure, yeah.
I totally psyched you out there. I was like, this is the last one. And then it wasn't. Okay. So you're talking about the difficulty of the process. And you write on page 49, this is in chapter 4.5, why, you might wonder, am I continuing to make this process sound so difficult this early in our journey?
Yeah.
And I say, because it is. And you say, remember, if I've learned anything, it is to manage your expectations. It bears repeating, expectations are the biggest killer in our society, in our world. Tell me about expectations, because it does feel like expectations are an important part in TMS treatment. How do we, or is it? Sometimes I'll frankly say that I feel like a downer, because people will come in and I'll want to say, look, it's not necessarily going to be easy. There's going to be some ups and downs. And they're just in the flush of discovering TMS, and maybe they've made a bunch of progress, and they probably think it's going to be easy from here on out, and they're going to be down to 0% in no time. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that where you're coming from, Forrest, is the same place I'm coming from. And I know that where I got it was directly from Dr. Sarno, because he always wanted to manage people's expectations. And he always said to people, don't think this is going to be easy. He wanted people to worry because, you know, similar to what Matt's mom said, it's like you don't want someone to give up because they've done really hard work and they're not better, because it's freaking hard. This is so much harder than taking a pill. This is so much harder than getting an electric stim treatment to your back or an injection into your spine or, you know, a massage. I mean, this sucks. It's horrible. Like, that's what I want to say to people, because if you expect it to be horrible, and then when you see yourself uncovering all this shit and you're like, oh God, it's horrible. I'm like, yeah, I said it was going to be horrible. And then people aren't like giving up, you know, they're like, oh, okay. Well, she said that. She said this sucks. She said that's why it's harder. She said that's why we have a society of people that are doped up and, you know, on all sorts of PT and all these things that are not helping them. And then they're going to these pain management doctors that are injecting them, or they're getting epidurals and, you know, okay. Well, then why are people doing that and that's not working? And then they're going to write in some journal and then they're going to cry and they're going to be like, shit, I can't believe I think that. Yes, 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 yes. And so that's where I want to step in and say, yes, if this wasn't harder, nobody would say it wasn't worth it. Everybody would say, oh, I'll take the pill. You know, I'll take the doctor's appointment. I mean, I want the pill. I don't want to do this. But that's the point. The point is that it's harder, but it's lasting. One thing I say in my book all the time is this is enduring healing. This is not healing for an hour so you can feel really better until you wake up tomorrow and you can't move. This is enduring healing, but it is a harder road. And so I want to manage people's expectations so they don't think, oh, well, I tried this and it sucks and so I'm out, you know, because this is something that is harder but is worth it and will lead to you being pain-free. And I have 1,000 people in a list that I can tell you that's what happened to them. And that's my years of work with Dr. Sarno, my years of work in my own practice. That's why I wrote the book. And that's what I want to inspire people about, is that, like, this is freaking real, but no, it's hard. You know, so prepare for hard, but then prepare for being done with this bullshit pain.
My therapist said that it's the hardest thing you're ever going to have to do in your life.
So, there you go.
Chime in there.
There you go. Thanks for sharing that.
I had a question, Nicole. With your experience with Dr. Sarno, with your own patients, is there any is there anything, any factor that you see? What is she there?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any factor that will determine someone's success? You know, I have heard belief is the biggest thing.
It appears that I lied.
I'll write her an email.
I think belief is a key and vital factor that, because I think that, so I tend to see things in terms of equanimity and peace of mind. And I think that if you have that belief, it's going to give you that peace of mind. I tend to think about Dr. Sarno's 80% who don't go to psychotherapy, and they may do some journaling, but it's not very supervised journaling. I think belief goes a long ways for them. Goes a long, long way for them.
Yeah.
I think it is kind of the rock solid foundation which helps so many. But as we've seen on the call tonight, sometimes it takes more than that. And sometimes it is a very, very painful and challenging process. We wish absolutely the best for you, Mouse Mom. There are some strategies, and maybe we can talk after the call about what some of those strategies are. But for now, let's wrap it up. I guess I'm going to turn off the recording. So just for the record, next week Nicole won't be joining us. I think it is a wonderful opportunity to be able to go through these chapters with the author. So I'm thinking that not for next week, but for the week after, let's do chapters 5 and 5.5, The Journey to Journal Speak and Journal Speak Itself. These chapters talk specifically about Nicole's experience, so it would be kind of absurd to do it without her. We don't have anything specifically planned for next week. Does anyone have any preferences for what we do next week? Want to chime in? Well, I suppose we can talk about it after the recording ends, but we could have an open discussion. People can post a thread about it if you want on the TMS Wiki's forum. That's at tmswiki.org/forum. Always an active discussion there. And you can post, just start a new thread and say, hey, this is what I want you to do next week. Until then, I will see you at the forum. Take care, everyone.
Thanks, Forrest.
Thank you.